Welcome to CME on ReachMD. This activity, What is the Role for TKIs in RCC? Highlights from the 18th annual meeting of the SUO is jointly provided by Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and ASIM and supported by an educational grant from Pfizer. Prior to beginning this activity, please be sure to review the faculty and commercial support disclosure statements as well as the learning objectives. Here is your host, Dr. Barry Menon.
I am Dr. Barry Menon, and I recently spoke with Dr. Vitaly Margulis at the 18th annual meeting of the Society of Urologic Oncology in Washington, D.C. Dr. Margulis is an associate professor of urology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. He is an expert surgeon using minimally invasive techniques to treat patients with soft tissue tumors as well as kidney, bladder, and other genitourinary cancers. At SUO, we talked about the ever-changing role of tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or TKIs, in the treatment of advanced renal cell carcinoma in light of the research findings that were presented at the meeting. Although renal cell carcinoma, or RCC, accounts for only 2-3% of all adult cancers, for those who present with or progress to advanced RCC, which can be up to 65% of patients, the 5-year survival rate has never been above 10%. TKIs are one of several types of preferred first-line therapies for relapsed or stage 4 and surgically unresectable metastatic RCC. TKIs are a group of targeted cancer therapies that inhibit the production of VEGF, a growth factor that allows angiogenesis and tumorigenesis. TKIs and some of these other agents have also demonstrated effectiveness in the second-line setting. But this is a rapidly changing field. The emergence of immunotherapy in the form of checkpoint inhibitors is reshaping the landscape of treatment options for advanced RCC and neo/adjuvant therapy for RCC. So, we expect to see some changes in the 2018 NCCN guidelines. Now, let's turn to our discussion. So happy to have you with us today, Dr. Margulis.
Glad to be here.
So, we are going to be talking about aspects of genitourinary cancer, specifically renal cell cancer, right now. In the session on immunotherapy of genitourinary cancer, what new data are being presented for locally advanced and metastatic disease in renal cell carcinoma?
So broadly speaking, it is a very exciting time for kidney cancer. Specifically, that has to do with our understanding of biology of kidney cancer that led to development of drugs, and specific class of drugs known as checkpoint inhibitors, that allow us to provide treatment to our patients with response rates that we haven't seen before.
And could you define checkpoint inhibitors a little better? Where do they check?
It's a good question. So basically what we have known is that kidney cancer, among other cancers, has a unique ability to turn off your immune system. And it does it through very sneaky and different ways. Some of them have to do with having certain receptors on the tumor cells that basically deactivate our immune system, our white cells, and that turns off the immune response. And so what we have learned is that we now have antibodies that can prevent that interaction and prevent these tumors from turning off our immune system. So our immune system stays on and can effectively, or more effectively, fight these cancers.
Now, how do these data affect, if at all, future NCCN guidelines?
So the first, I would say, what I would call revolution in kidney cancer occurred when we've developed targeted therapies, specifically anti-angiogenic therapies. And these were the molecules that, mostly taken orally, that would prevent tumors from growing new blood vessels. And that happened roughly in early 2000s, and that led to development of multiple drugs that basically prevent the vasculature from growing.
The VEGF.
The VEGF, yeah, but, and various other receptors, but the idea was to prevent angiogenesis. We know that kidney cancer is an extremely angiogenic tumor. And so up until then, these targeted agents, such as sunitinib, sorafenib, among others, pazopanib, became first-line therapy for patients with metastatic kidney cancer. Now, what happened over the last few years with our understanding of immunobiology of kidney cancer is that now we have drugs that reactivate our immune system. And most recently, and this happened literally within the last year, there have been a clinical trial which compared head-to-head in the first-line setting a drug like Sutent, which is a checkpoint inhibitor, and a combination of two different checkpoint inhibitors. The trials was checkmate 214 and was presented a few months ago at the European Oncology Meeting. And the findings were staggering. And what I mean by that is that the combination of checkpoint inhibitors outperformed our standard first-line option, which was a TKI. Not only in terms of overall survival, progression-free survival, and tumor response. So not only that did that happen, these drugs were actually better tolerated. And when we checked patients' quality of life, the quality of among pretty much every single quality of life domain, the patients did better while taking these checkpoint inhibitors. So not only now we have drugs that are more effective in the perspective of oncologic outcome, but also are less toxic.
So the guidelines seem to be behind the times.
Correct. Correct, yes. So, as you know, these checkpoint inhibitors are now approved in the second-line setting, but with these new trials emerging in the front-line setting, I think it's only a matter of time before these drugs will be approved in that setting as well.
Now, what are we learning about the very important issue of predicting response?
Well, that remains a million-dollar question. We know that only roughly 30 to 40% of patients treated with immune checkpoint inhibitors would actually have a response. Another 30 to 40% would have stable disease. And so there's a significant proportion of patients that don't respond to checkpoint inhibitors. In fact, in the pivotal checkpoint checkmate trial that I just mentioned, if you categorize patients as having favorable prognostic risk versus intermediate and poor, patients with favorable prognostic risk actually did better with a TKI. And patients with intermediate to poor risk actually did perform better and had better oncologic outcomes with checkpoint inhibitor. And so there is significant need in terms of prediction and our understanding of which patients should go on to which therapy. And that's a very hot, obviously, topic and area of research.
Now, what role will immunotherapy versus TKIs play in those with predicted good response versus those with predicted intermediate poor response, as you just were talking about, and what's the takeaway?
Right. So the takeaway is we don't know. The data needs to mature a little bit. Right now, the preliminary signal from these trials seems to indicate that patients that are categorized as good risk in terms of their prognosis, they're going to live for a long time, they seem to be actually doing better with a checkpoint with a TKI. And patients that have intermediate to poor prognosis will actually benefit from a checkpoint inhibitor. And I think if you want my opinion and looking into the future, I would imagine that that's how this is going to shake out.
Now, are there any new developments in genetic testing for developing neoadjuvant or adjuvant treatments?
Well, genetic testing obviously alludes to the whole theme of personalized medicine. And there are multiple laboratories around the country, and every major academic center has a program devoted to finding out and understanding how we can use genetics and genomics to predict which patients should be treated, how they should be treated, how they will respond, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a very complex and rapidly advancing field. What is pertinent to checkpoint inhibitors right now? The clinical trials indicate that if we were to stain the tumor tissue, for some of the markers predictive of immune infiltration, such as PD-L1 staining, seems to indicate that in patients who show higher proportion of PD-L1 staining, they actually respond better to the checkpoint inhibitors. So higher immune infiltration, higher ligand staining, better response to the drugs that target that.
But that's a phenotypic.
Correct.
What about the genotypic? Is there a correlation there?
Correct. The genes drive the phenotype, and right. So that basically is a quick and indirect way to measure the genotype.
I see.
You're absolutely right. The next area that I think warrants discussion is using genetic sequencing, genetic profiling. And that's, again, very hot and rapidly evolving area of investigation. And actually, in this meeting, there was a presentation that documented that kidney tumors can be classified as angiogenic type, which would obviously be treated probably better by a TKI, anti-angiogenic drug, or the immune infiltrating type, which would be better treated by a checkpoint inhibitor.
Now, what role do you see TKIs playing in neoadjuvant therapy based on what you've seen and heard at this meeting?
I guess the better question that I would ask is, what is the future of neoadjuvant therapy in kidney cancer? I think we've done several trials with TKIs. And TKIs, unfortunately, have more of a static profile. And they may shrink the tumors, but very few complete responses are seen with these drugs. And so I think that TKIs can be used to shrink the tumor before surgery, to make the surgery easier in highly complicated cases. But where it gets really interesting is with checkpoint inhibitors. And the idea here is that if we can give an immune-stimulating drug while the primary tumor is still in place, i.e. in a neoadjuvant setting, you essentially have an in situ vaccine, right? So you're stimulating your immune system. You have very high antigenic load. The tumor is still there. Then you go in and remove the tumor and then give additional checkpoint inhibition to continue this sort of treatment. And so that seems to be very interesting and very promising paradigm. There is a clinical trial in this setting that basically gives a new adjuvant checkpoint inhibitor followed by surgery, followed by additional checkpoint inhibition in patients that have high risk of not being cured by surgery alone.
Well, this certainly seems like a very exciting time in the area of kidney cancer. We've spoken about several things. You've given us your take on it. Is there any other area that you've seen here or you think would be a very important communication point for our audience?
This is, again, a very exciting time in kidney cancer. And I think this is where I will toot my urologic horn here, in as much as that this is really exciting time for clinical trials. And I think we really need to come together as a community to really enroll as many of these patients as possible so we can establish and answer some of these questions that you've asked me.
So you're talking about the medical oncologist and the urologic oncologist.
Correct. Correct. We need to play better. We need to play more. And I think this will all translate into better care for our patients.
Let's review some of the studies Dr. Margulies discussed. Dr. Margulies discussed the CheckMate 214 study, a landmark study comparing the safety and efficacy of sunitinib, a TKI, to combination therapy with nivolumab and ipilimumab, which are checkpoint inhibitors, in about 1,000 patients with treatment-naive, advanced or metastatic clear cell renal carcinoma. The primary analysis focused on the roughly 800 intermediate and poor-risk patients. However, there was also an intent-to-treat analysis, which included an additional 200 patients who were deemed favorable risk. Risk was determined by a number of factors, including the Karnofsky Performance Status Score, time from initial diagnosis to randomization, hemoglobin level, corrected serum calcium concentration, absolute neutrophil count, and platelet count. The EMOTION 150 study of gene signatures was a phase 2, three-arm study of about 100 patients in each arm, looking at the combination of PD-L1 blockade with atezolizumab and VEGF inhibition with the antibody bevacizumab, comparing it to single-agent atezolizumab and to the standard of care sunitinib. The primary endpoint was progression-free survival for all comers in the intent-to-treat population, and the results showed that there was no difference between the treatment groups. But for the first time in kidney cancer clinical trials, PD-L1 expression on the tumor immune cells was analyzed, and the results showed that response to the atezolizumab combinations improved with increased PD-L1 expression in the microenvironment. This was true for both PD-L1 expressions of at least 1% and at least 5%. As Dr. Margulies discussed, as part of the EMOTION trial, the patient's tumors and blood underwent a variety of different assays, including whole exome sequencing, immunohistochemistry, and RNA sequencing on almost all the tumors in this trial. The RNA sequencing showed that tumors could be grouped into three subtypes based on their predominant gene expression. For example, tumors that had an angiogenic signature had high levels of VEGF-A. Immunogenic tumors expressed high levels of CD8, indicating high levels of T effector cells. And the third group were tumors that might be somewhat immunosuppressed that had a myeloid inflammation signature. The study investigators are now asking whether, based on these gene signatures, might some tumor types respond better to certain types of therapies. Early results indicate that this may be the case, for example, that tumors with an angiogenic signature respond better to sunitinib alone than to atezolizumab alone. Study investigators also are looking at whether these RNA signatures can predict response based on PD-L1 expression. Next, we discuss treatment guidelines and future directions for treatment of advanced RCC. Are there any new updates in the guidelines on the management of small renal masses?
Well, as you know, this is also a very hot topic and a somewhat evolving field. And there were a few updates. I would say nothing major, no major changes, but there were a few clarifications. Number one topic had to do with the role of the biopsy. And do we biopsy kidney tumors? You know, pretty much any malignancy that gets treated, usually we get a biopsy first, establish a diagnosis, and move on with treatment. Kidney cancer is unusual in that most of the kidney cancers are treated without a biopsy. So if we see a renal mass, we presume that it's kidney cancer, and we render treatment, which is, again, not really how it's done in most other malignancies. And so there's an ongoing debate. What should be the role of the kidney biopsy? And I think the newest guidelines sort of clarified that really, because majority of these tumors will end up being kidney cancer, there's no need for routine kidney biopsy, except in unusual cases where we suspect metastasis to the kidney or where the diagnosis is not clear. And in those cases, the biopsy could be acceptable. But as a routine practice, the guidelines actually, to some degree, discourage performing routine biopsy unless it's part of the clinical trial of some sort. The second clarification, really not a change, the second clarification from the guidelines was utilization of nephron-sparing surgery. And again, recommendation is that we should try to preserve as much kidney function by performing nephron-sparing surgery, such as ablation or partial nephrectomy, whenever possible. However, in situations where, and especially if there's no imperative indication for nephron-sparing and the tumors are complex, there's nothing wrong with performing a radical surgery, as not to increase the potential complications in these patients. And so there was a period of time in our field where the pendulum was swinging. We went completely from performing radical nephrectomies in everybody to now there's a big push to try to nephron spare in every single case. And I think we're realizing that in some cases when in complicated tumors and without imperative indication, we can actually compromise people's outcomes. And so the guidelines caution against that, and they do recommend radical surgery in appropriate cases. Finally, there is a section on ablation. Ablation is again, also an evolving and somewhat hot topic in our field. And ablation has to do with, instead of extirpating tumors surgically, utilizing either heat or cold, usually in a percutaneous fashion, to kill the tumor. And the guidelines actually state now that ablation is acceptable treatment, and again, in appropriately selected cases. Usually older patients, smaller tumors, but it's actually a reasonable option.
How does multidisciplinary management fit into the use of TKIs as adjuvant therapy?
The adjuvant therapy field, and you know, there are multiple trials, and pretty much every agent that's been approved in a metastatic setting has been studied or is being studied in an adjuvant setting. And the idea here is, you know, we operate on a lot of tumors. We know with the high probability of recurrence, and we want to be able to minimize these recurrences. So can we give these patients after surgery some sort of therapy to prevent the cancers from recurring? And again, there are multiple trials, but most recently there was a trial of sunitinib, also known as Sutent, that demonstrated delay in progression in patients who got the adjuvant treatment. So patients that got the treatment recurred at a less frequent rate. Based on that trial, which was a randomized phase 3 trial, observation versus Sutent in patients with high risk of recurrence. Based on the findings of this trial, Sutent is now approved as the first adjuvant therapy in kidney cancer. And so we're obligated to discuss this with our patients. There are problems with the trial. There are controversies. One of the controversies has to do with the fact that even though the sunitinib increases the time to recurrence or decreases the probability of recurrence, the overall survival in this trial was not any different. So patients seemed to recur later, but their survival overall was not affected. And so we as a clinicians and the patients have to discuss this data and make a sort of a shared and informed decision making whether this type of therapy is appropriate. But it is, again, exciting because now finally, after probably, I would say, over 10 to 15 different clinical trials, that we have an agent that's approved in adjuvant setting. One more thing I would want to point out that with advent, again, of checkpoint inhibitors, these agents are not being studied in adjuvant setting as well. None of the data is mature, but the opportunity to increase your immune response to occult metastatic disease is very exciting, and I'm hoping that some of these trials will be positive. And not only there are single-agent trials, there are trials of combination of checkpoint inhibitors as well.
What did we learn in today's state-of-the-art lecture on advanced renal cell carcinoma that we haven't heard about yet?
Again, somewhat of a shifting landscape, and it has to do with our understanding of biology of kidney cancer, and some of the newer agents have been approved. And when we talk about advanced kidney cancer, I think we need to understand that there's tumors that are at high risk for recurrence, but manageable by surgery alone, and then patients with metastatic kidney cancer. And I would sort of say that those patients are lumped in the same bucket, although I think they're quite different patients. So for the patients that have been operated surgically and at high risk for recurrence, I think, again, the finding of the Sutent or sunitinib trial being positive, so these patients now have an option for adjuvant therapy. But also for these patients, again, there's ongoing clinical trials where checkpoint inhibitors are studied. For patients with metastatic kidney cancer, and this is probably the most rapidly shifting sort of paradigm, based on, again, the recent clinical trials that have been presented at the European Oncology Meeting, there's now a combination checkpoint inhibitor trial that's shown to be superior to what used to be standard therapy with sunitinib or TKI. And so I see that, again, the sands are shifting. I think the checkpoint inhibitors and combination most likely will move to be the first and become the first line therapy for patients with metastatic kidney cancer. And the hard question is when do we use what? When do we use the TKIs and when do we use the checkpoint inhibitors? And that, I think some of the newer genetic profiling studies may help us answer that question. And finally, I want to say that from the surgical perspective, there's always a question of, well, what should the role of surgery be? Should we still be taking out the primary tumors when the cancer is already spread? And the data seems to, again, over and over, confirm that patients whose primary tumors have been removed tend to do better than patients whose tumors are left in situ.
What have we learned in regard to current or ongoing clinical trials in regard to immunotherapy, TKIs, combination of, whether it is here or any other meetings that you have attended or heard of?
Right. So this is where it gets really exciting for me, at least. And I've always felt that, you know, cancer is a very complicated phenomenon with multiple biologic pathways affected. And it would only make sense that we maximize our therapeutic strategies by attacking cancer from different angles. And so case in point, as we've discussed earlier, we've had now since for over 10 years now targeted therapies that attack the vascular pathway of the kidney cancer, that prevent the kidney cancer from growing new blood vessels and growing and spreading. And now we have the checkpoint inhibitors, which reactivate our own immune system to fight cancer better. And the question is, you know, can we combine the agents from the individual class of drugs and also combine drugs that work by completely different mechanism of action and see if we can leverage that benefit to our patients? And the answer is, at least based on preliminary data, is very exciting. And again, case in point is the trial of combination of checkpoint inhibitors seems to perform very well, better than individual checkpoint inhibitors alone. And there are several ongoing clinical trials where the idea is to combine a TKI with a checkpoint inhibitor. It certainly makes biologic rationale, since we're attacking different cancer pathways. But again, the preliminary data of the combination trials that are ongoing, so we don't have the final data, but interim analyses and early looks, which should be interpreted with a grain of caution. But the preliminary data seems to indicate that combining the checkpoint inhibitors with targeted therapies, such as sunitinib, for example, does improve and does provide cumulative action and improve outcomes. Again, the data is maturing. I think we'll see more within the next 2 years, but this is very rapidly moving and exciting field in kidney cancer.
Any final thoughts as you are wrapping up the meeting here, the society meeting? What holds in the future? What is coming up?
I think if I have to summarize the key points here is that surgery still has an important role in management of kidney cancer. I think the future of treatment will have to do with individualizing therapy based on most likely genetic profiling. So we can look at individual tumor, individual patient characteristics and say that, you know, you are best treated with their targeted therapies versus a different patient who may be best treated by combination or a checkpoint inhibitor. And finally, the role of the individual therapy will have to do with attacking various biologic pathways in combination.
To expand further on our discussion with Dr. Margolese, he began by mentioning some of the highlights of the recently updated AUA guidelines for the management of localized renal masses as presented by Dr. Ithar Derwish. The recommendations regarding renal mass biopsy were an important part of the guidelines, and the guidelines now recommend RMB when a mass is suspected to be hematologic, metastatic, inflammatory, or infectious. When considering utility of renal mass biopsy, patients should be counseled regarding the rationale, positive and negative predictive values, and the potential risks of non-diagnostic rates of renal mass biopsy. This is generally a very safe procedure. Dr. Derwish noted that the overall incidence of side effects or complications is about 1%. The sensitivity, specificity, and positive predictive value of RMB are in the upper 90s. The non-diagnostic rate is about 14%, which can be substantially reduced with a repeat biopsy. However, a non-malignant biopsy may not accurately indicate whether the tumor is benign. Regarding partial nephrectomy, Statement 14 indicates that physicians should prioritize partial nephrectomy for the management of clinical T1a renal masses when intervention is indicated. In this setting, partial nephrectomy minimizes the risk of chronic kidney disease progression and is associated with favorable oncologic outcomes, including excellent local control. With respect to morbidity, partial nephrectomy can be associated with an increased risk of urologic complications, but most can be successfully managed with conservative approaches. Statement 19 regarding radical nephrectomy was also one of the key guidelines. It is shown here. Statements 24 to 27 review thermal ablation. Specifically, physicians should consider thermal ablation as an alternate approach for the management of clinical T1a renal masses less than 3 centimeters in size. And for those who elect thermal ablation, a percutaneous technique is preferred over a surgical approach to minimize morbidity. It should be noted that the meta-analysis on which these recommendations were based demonstrated an increased risk of local recurrence or primary treatment failure after one treatment. However, as Dr. Derwish noted, most of these types of local recurrence or primary treatment failures can be managed successfully and usually with a repeat ablation. This guideline was discussed further by Dr. Thomas Atwell at the SUO conference. He noted the importance of the AUA recommendation of renal mass biopsy prior to or concurrent with thermal ablation, especially as thermal ablation is translated to the more general population with renal tumors, particularly young patients. For those patients, a definitive pathology is important for both the patient and the provider to guide subsequent surveillance. Dr. Margolis then discussed the results of the ESTRAC study, a randomized double-blind phase 3 trial of 650 patients with high-risk clear cell renal carcinoma who received either sunitinib or placebo for 1 year as adjuvant therapy until disease recurrence. The primary endpoint was disease-free survival, according to blinded independent reviews. The secondary endpoints were investigator-assessed disease-free survival, overall survival, and safety. You can see that the disease-free survival curves suggest a significant advantage to those who received a year of sunitinib compared to those who received placebo. But the overall survival curves, a secondary endpoint, are overlapping, showing no benefit. So, as Dr. David McDermott noted when he discussed these data, this is a controversial area and hopefully adjuvant immune therapy will offer a better advantage in future studies. Dr. Margolis also discussed what Dr. Rana McKay presented in her state-of-the-art lecture on the evolving management of renal cell carcinoma. She provided an overview of the recent studies of novel combinations of TKIs and immunotherapy. Starting with the Atkins study presented in 2016 at ESMO, the combination of axitinib with pembrolizumab, a PD-L/PD-1 targeting monoclonal antibody, was evaluated in a phase 1 trial which had 52 patients with clear cell histology and no prior therapy. They reported an objective response rate of 71%. Chowry and colleagues presented the data of axitinib and avelumab, which is a PD-L1 targeting agent, in a similarly designed trial, including clear cell patients with no prior therapy. The response rate was 58.2%. In this past ESMO from 2017, the results from a study of the combination of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab were presented. In the phase 2 portion of the trial, it restricted eligibility to clear cell patients having received no more than 2 lines of prior therapy, and the response rate was 63%. And finally, the combination of cabozantinib and nivolumab, with or without ipilimumab, was also presented at ESMO this past year. This trial included patients with all genitourinary malignancies, but there were only 2 patients with sarcomatoid RCC. The response rate was 33% in that study. Overall, these early results suggest improved responses with combination therapy compared to monotherapy, as Dr. Margolis discussed. This concludes our CME program covering highlights of the 18th annual meeting of the Society of Urologic Oncology meeting in Washington, D.C. with Dr. Vitaly Margulis. Thank you for participating.
The preceding activity was supported by Pfizer. To receive your free CME credit or to download this activity, go to reachmd.com/CME. This is CME on ReachMD. Be part of the knowledge.